Hello, and welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, where we explore how the health of our planet affects the health of the people on it, and how we, as healthcare professionals, have the power to lead the way in curbing the climate crisis and to be pioneers in building sustainable healthcare systems. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Ashling, a junior doctor and member of the EcoMedics team, and we have an incredible lineup of guests who will be joining me on each episode to share their experience and expertise about health and the environment. Today, I would like to welcome the incredible Hugh Montgomery. It only makes sense for Hugh to be our first guest on the EcoMedics podcast, as he played a big part in inspiring its creation. Hugh is a professor of intensive care medicine at the Whittington Hospital in London and is director of the University College London Centre for Human Health and Performance. Aside from publishing more than 500 papers, he is acclaimed for discovering the first gene for human physical performance and is celebrated as a leader in healthcare sustainability, co-chairing the Lancet Countdown on Health and Climate Change. He is outspoken in holding people and organisations accountable for their role in the climate crisis, frequently debunking misconceptions around the topic and fighting for impactful change towards sustainability. This year, he was appointed an OBE for his services to intensive care medicine and climate change. Hugh, welcome to the EcoMedics podcast.
Good to see you, Ashling. Thanks for having me. It's the last time I saw you was Edinburgh, I think, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mentioned at the beginning about your role in inspiring the podcast, so I'd like to give some context to that. As you just mentioned, I met you at the World Extreme Medicine Conference last year in Edinburgh, where I heard you talk with such conviction about the reality of the climate emergency that our planet faces. It was impossible not to have felt moved by the truths that you conveyed so powerfully, and I, among many others in that room, felt deeply compelled to take action urgently. I therefore joined the EcoMedics team with a plan to start a podcast sharing the work that healthcare professionals are doing in advocating for environmental sustainability. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I'm glad you're doing it. We need more of you.
You've worn many hats over the course of your career, Hugh. Please tell us what took you down the road of healthcare sustainability.
Oh, God. I mean, I suppose you'd like to say there's a plan, but there wasn't. I suppose what took me into the climate change world was accidental. So in the 90s, I was doing the genetic work you've talked about, the genes on performance and so forth. And that meant that I was reading the cutting edge papers for that sort of work, which were appearing in the big journals, Nature, Science, and so forth. And if you've ever looked at Nature, it's a bit like a very highbrow Cosmo. It's a sort of, you know, lots of stories next to each other, as it were. So you might be looking at genetics, but next to it, there might be something on string theory or black holes or early hominids or something. And so there were the papers on climate change. And I started looking at them and thinking, well, this looks very frightening. But it was a time when the newspapers were still saying, oh, there's probably no such thing, or it might be getting colder. And they were at such opposites that I thought it was an important thing to understand and reach a decision about. So I spent a few years trying to understand the climate physics and trying to understand the impacts. And it didn't take long to realise that we were in desperate, desperate trouble. So I've spent 22 odd years failing to achieve effective change. That's not entirely my fault, but nothing has happened. And the problem is that we are now out of time. We have to do nothing but try to solve this problem now.
You're incredibly knowledgeable about the real life consequences of the climate emergency. And I'd really like to explore with you some of the areas we will start to see the impacts. But first, would you mind giving us an idea of where we are in terms of global warming in literal terms? So we're told a lot about rising temperatures and hitting levels at which we cannot come back from. What are some of these figures? Are they relevant? And what are the projections looking like?
Okay, so the projections have often been wrong, and they've always been consistently wrong in the conservative direction. So things have always been vastly worse than have been predicted, is the first thing to say. And that's meant that every alarm call has got increasingly more alarming, and we've ignored all of them to the current state that we're in today. So the climate issue relates to the fact, and we've known this for over 100 years, that these gases, the so-called greenhouse gases, have a chemical property where they let shortwave radiation in and they retain longwave radiation. So that means light gets through and heat doesn't get out, we'll put it simply. And we're adding more and more greenhouse gases, which means we're trapping more and more energy. And I'm not a fan of talking about degrees, because degrees, firstly, averaged over an entire global near surface atmosphere is hard to comprehend. And also temperature rises of 1 and a bit degrees. I mean, why does that sound remotely worrying? I mean, it just doesn't, does it? And it's allowed people to say, well, you know, what's wrong with a bit of warming? We don't like it being cold in the winter, do we? The issue is about energy gain. We are trapping, or have trapped since 1998 alone, the equivalent of 2.8 billion Hiroshima bombs worth of energy in our gaseous atmosphere. And we've trapped approaching 30 billion Hiroshima bombs of energy in our oceans since that time. And that's doing a lot of bad stuff. Firstly, it's raising temperatures. Yes, it is. And if you raise temperatures, you get more evaporation. That means more water in the atmosphere. When the water condenses out, the latent heat of evaporation is released, so you get more storms and so forth. It means that you're getting ice melt in the sea surface, which we're seeing, for instance, in the Arctic, with colossal rapid scale loss of Arctic sea ice area. But actually, the volume is going down much, much more steeply because the ice is thinning more quickly than it is the area is reducing. We've got land ice melting. So just parts of the West Greenland ice shelf are now contributing 1.1 million metric tons of fresh water into the sea a minute. The Thwaites Glacier adding 1.5 million litres of fresh water a second to the sea.
Those figures are just crazy. They're quite incomprehensible and a bit overwhelming to hear you talk about them, actually, because it's just mind-blowing hearing those numbers.
Well, it's just the start. And that's causing sea levels to rise by approaching a centimetre every 2 years. Now, the problem is that things aren't going to get better quickly, because a fifth of the CO2 we release today will still be cooking our planet in 33,000 years' time and 7% in 100,000 years' time. But worse than that, we're on an exponential curve of emissions of CO2. Worse than that, we're driving positive feedback loops now. So if you think of the fires in Australia in our northern hemisphere winter, the ones just pre-COVID, just those fires in just the east of just one province of just one country added another 3% to the global greenhouse gas emissions. And we aren't even adding the fires in California that we hear about every year, in the Amazon rainforest, the three times the number of them that are appearing in the Congo, for instance, in Angola. The Indonesian fires, the ones we had in Canada, if you remember last year, when Canada was ablaze, the ones in Europe all of last year. So that's a positive feedback loop.
I remember something you said, actually, when I saw your talk in Edinburgh, that the Amazon is now a net emitter of CO2. Obviously, we see that as an oxygen basin, and that I found that quite shocking to hear.
Yeah, and it's all of the world's major rainforests are now net emitters. We've chopped down so much of them that there aren't enough trees left to absorb down, and they're now catching fire. Partly they're being set light to, but they're catching fire also because of lightning strikes, because they're now so dry. And that is, of course, those fires trigger a positive feedback loop. The drier it gets, the more the fires are. The more the fires, the more CO2 is released. The more CO2, the hotter it gets. So with ice melt, we're losing surface ice, exposing dark sea and land, which is absorbing more heat, which means actually we've doubled the rate of energy gain in the world in the last 14 years alone. And as the ice and snow melt further, as it gets hotter, that rate of energy gain is going to go up. We're heating carbonate rocks, which are releasing methane, which is 83 times as powerful a greenhouse gas in the first 20 years as is CO2. We're melting methane hydrates. We're releasing methane from warming wetlands. So we've got all of these positive feedbacks, but worse than that, not only have we got positive feedback loops, but the changes in the state of the climate and the weather are often binary.
You're talking there a lot about how the CO2 and methane that's released into the atmosphere is trapped, and it's not necessarily a case of those immediate effects, but the long-lasting effects of those, so that when you keep emitting and keep emitting, it's a cumulative effect for a really long time. And that's something that I wonder if people actually recognize, that it's not just a case of we're putting it into the atmosphere, it will go eventually, but actually it's going to be adding to the problem. So even if we stop now, all of what we've put into the atmosphere is already going to be sort of writing our fate for the next however many years.
Yeah, so the IPCC scientific working groups point out very clearly, they're saying that even if we stop all our greenhouse gas emissions right now and we start sucking it out of the atmosphere with machines that haven't yet been invented, we're still locked into climate change now for thousands of years. Thousands of years we're locked into this for. And the more we add, the worse it's going to get.
And contribute to those feedback loops like you just talked about.
Indeed, and there are many more too. And as I say, those binary state changes, if you look at polar warming, that's happening at 2 to 3 times the rate of general surface warming. And there are things called Dansgaard-Oeschger events, which are sudden changes in polar temperature. And it's thought that we've triggered one. And if we do, temperatures got there very, very quickly. And when they got very, very quickly, you massively accelerate the ice melt. And that was said to be warned that we might have triggered one, and that was stated 2 years ago. And then you suddenly see the truth of this. So on the 21st of March of this year and the 22nd, the temperature in the Arctic was 47 degrees Celsius higher than normal. 47. And in the Arctic, it was 30 degrees higher than normal. So when those things happen, you get even quicker change. You start melting the ends, for instance, of the Thwaites Glacier, which are the blocks of ice that support on the continental shelf, the glacier. When those go, the glaciers are able to run straight into the ocean. And then sea levels really start changing very quickly. Those sorts of changes for Thwaites will add 10 to 15 meters to sea levels. Now, these sorts of things have huge human impacts, along with the extreme weather events, not just the fires, but the extreme floods. Do you remember in the summer, the flooding all around the world, but in London, Germany, the Belgian border, and of course in China, with tens of thousands losing their lives, and the New York subway, if you remember those pictures. And the reminder that things are going to continue to get worse even if we stop now.
So you mentioned there about
Yeah.
flooding. What other kind of impacts would we expect to see if we continue on this trajectory? Or even if we were to stop now, as you'd said already, what have we already committed
I
to?
mean, we could talk a lot about health impacts through vector-borne diseases, et cetera, but in the end, they're irrelevant to the fact that with massive rapid sea level rise, you displace people. And even at the current rate of sea level rise, which I've explained will be, it will be massively superseded in my view. Even with that rate of level, you're looking at potentially 2/3 of a billion people underwater in your lifetime. So they'll have moved long before then. That's a lot of people. On top of that, 19% of the Earth's surface area, currently occupied by humans, will be uninhabitable by humans. And that means approaching 3 billion people dead or migrating. So you've already got half the world's population dead or on the move.
Sorry, what time frame did you say that was happening in?
Well, probably in the next 30 to 50 years.
Which is very, very soon and quite a far cry from our sort of grandchildren and great grandchildren, which is the rhetoric that seems to be played quite frequently.
This is you. And the working group two, the IPCC working group two, 4 weeks ago, talked about us needing immediate and aggressive concerted action to solve this problem. And by immediate and aggressive, they're talking about getting this sorted within a few years, i.e., halving greenhouse gas emissions within 7 years. 92 months we've got left to halve global greenhouse gas emissions. And even then, it will be catastrophic because that will only just potentially keep us below 1.5 degrees. But of course, that's irrelevant. It means we're still adding 5 Hiroshima bombs of energy a second. And they say that if we fail to do that, and I quote, we miss a rapidly closing window to secure a livable future. Right? That's their words, a livable future. So this is no longer some ethereal long-term risk that might affect people in future generations. This is me. I'm 60. It will probably be devastating to me, but you're not 60. So there is nothing but this that we should be focusing on now.
I can appreciate that there is increasing awareness about the climate emergency, but when you hear some of the figures that you're stating, I'm just so shocked that the world is just going about their normal lives without thinking we need to rethink everything we're doing as a matter of urgency. And that was something that I really felt when I heard you first talk about these figures and the realities of what's happening. And it just seems mad that even when these kind of reports are coming out, you know, there's been conferences every single year, the world leaders are aware of these figures and these facts. How is it that they're turning a blind eye?
Well, because a lot of them don't want anything to be done. So if you look at our national risk register, in the top three for us is climate change, cyber and pandemics. So right in the top is climate change. If you look at Russia's risk register, at the top is action on climate change, because the only way they get money is by selling fossil fuels. And if you look in the international negotiations, you've got the Arab states and others that are producing oil and gas. You've got Poland with coal, Austria with its trees, Canada with its tar sands. You've got large numbers of people who don't want any change. And you've got large numbers of businesses who are making money as incumbents in those processes. You've got governments who are transient, who don't want to make these difficult decisions because the transition was always going to be disruptive. I mean, now it's going to be very, very disruptive because we've got to do it so very, very quickly.
So essentially, there is a sense that there are people gaining from not reducing things like coal, not reducing energy, and there's a short-sightedness in many of the political structures because of the fact that they're only thinking the next few years in order to keep in power, and they're not willing to make those big changes and sacrifices. Is that essentially what you're saying is a part of the problem?
Part of the problem. The other problem is, of course, they're so poorly educated, most politicians. So the people like you and your listeners, I think we forget that, A, most of the people that do that are quite bright. But secondly, you're extraordinarily broadly educated. So you've been taught chemistry and biology and physics and maths and sociology and psychology and anatomy. And you've got to understand health economics and. So you can string it together. But if you've just done PPE at university and then gone to work as a SPAD and climbed up a political tree, you probably don't even have the intellectual capacity to understand this because you've got no scientific training at all. And being fair to governments, once you're in, you're fighting a newspaper headline or whatever at the time. You're swatting flies. You don't have time to really give this thought. So I suppose that's a shorthand way of saying there is hope, but the hope cannot be pinned on others. The hope cannot be, oh, someone will come up with something, and there'll be magic pixie dust that will solve this at some point, or the politicians will sort it, because Alok Sharm, who chaired COP26, was in tears at the end of it because he knew it was a waste of time. So the answer is, it's down to us, and we can change the world because what we do affects other people and leverages changes in cash flow and money, but we have to get on with it now. And we can't just say, oh, well, we recycle our Coke cans and we're trying to be, quote, more sustainable. It has to be very much more scientific than that and much more strategic.
Some would describe you as outspoken in your approach to advocating for these matters. I recall you talking about this concept that you can't tell people scary stuff without ending on a positive note. But when it comes to the climate crisis, the truth is that there is no happy ending if we keep on going like this. So I find it very refreshing, actually, to hear you speak so frankly about these matters. Something you just said there about, obviously, the fact that there is a limit to what the national and international level politicians seem to be doing to take action. And you'd mentioned that it's down to us. What kind of chance do we stand against such big corporations that have vested interests in continuing the current trajectory and not reducing our impacts on the environment as individuals?
It's the only thing that will work. And it's individual actions only ever been the thing that works. It works because of where you spend your money, how you cast your vote. And these things matter when they're done together. And again, we've forgotten that in the Second War, there were French teachers who stood up, one particular 5'3" woman who volunteered because she spoke French, volunteered to be parachuted into occupied France as a radio operator, knowing that the average time before we'd been caught and tortured and killed was 11 days, and still volunteered because it was the right thing to do. And now is the time for us all to stand and do what's right. And if we do, yes, of course it will change, because most people running businesses are not evil. They just are either uneducated or uneducated and feel disempowered, because if they don't keep making the money, then they go out of business and they don't know how to deal with that. The simple answer is to vote with your money, buy differently, spend differently, and the companies will go where your money goes, as will politicians. So if we want legislation change, we need to create the space into which politicians can move. And your generation have done that. The Tory party would not have been anywhere near a green agenda in any way, shape or form 10 years ago. But they changed, and they changed on a sixpence. And that was largely because they realised that your generation would not vote for them unless they had moved into that space. That's why it changed. It wasn't because there was a sudden change in belief. There was a realpolitik recognition that they weren't going to get voted into power. You have enormous power, and you can change your spending and behavioural habits in 3 seconds. Every one of you, by the way, the advertisers will tell us, can influence the behaviour of 7 other people, probably more. But there are 7 people who either respect you so much or love you so much that they will do what you ask them to do, even if it's to put on an orange wig and a clown nose. They would do it if you gave them a reason for it. So we have influence, and that's on our parents. Well, not mine. That would take a seance to contact them. But you are young enough, most of you, to have parents who are alive, and your siblings, and your colleagues at work, but actually also the bosses in your universities or in your medical schools or in your hospitals. They want you to help them. My own provost, I'm sure he wouldn't mind saying, Michael Spence, is a fantastic man who wants to see change, but he cannot do it on his own. It helps him enormously if the students are pressing him to do it and are coming up with solutions and engaging with him. I've been speaking to lots of the big drug companies and others. They want to be forced. They say it helps them. They want to make these changes. The more we mandate and say, we won't buy from you unless you decarbonize by 50% scope 1 to 3 in 7 years. If we do that, it really helps them because they can go to their shareholders and say, we've got to do it right, because there's no business if we don't. So you have enormous power. But just a reminder, it can't be fluffy. It can't be, oh, well, we thought we might, I don't know, just go for nitrous or DES or something in operating theatres or recycle our batteries. All of those things are good, but it has to be focused to saying what actually delivers a minimum of an 8% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions now, this year and every year thereafter.
What are your thoughts on groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Insulate Britain, groups which are perceived as taking extreme action to advocate for climate action?
Well, I'm going to use this, not that I'm religious, but I'm going to use that sort of biblical quote of play to Caesar what's due to Caesar and so forth, which is, I think we are in a time of colossal crisis. And at the moment, people have to find their way of preventing that, because if we sit back, it's all over. My own personal approach has been to try to be scientific and reasonable and to engage with people for change, but in a real world way. I'm not a fan, for instance, of people remaining invested in fossil fuels on the idea that because they own shares, it allows them to talk to Shell or ExxonMobil. That will not change their behaviour. They are conning themselves or just lying because they want to get the money out of it. Those sorts of conversations are not worth having. But having conversations with others in a more reasonable way works. Now, I've not personally gone and chained myself up to oil barrels and got arrested with Extinction Rebellion. The reason I haven't done it is because, for me personally, given where I am in life at 60 and what I do, I think it might prevent me having the access to talk to people who would listen to me. It might put them off. But that's not for me to say that I'm in any way against people who do other things. Because we are out of time at the moment. I think Extinction Rebellion and Insulate Britain, at the beginning, if you think back, served a very important purpose of actually putting this on the agenda and saying, this is really urgent. This is a really massive problem. And this cannot be a beard stroking exercise for 25 years. This is a here and now issue.
And actually, the view, I think, about them has changed because of that change in perspective that they've created. But initially, they were being referred to as terrorist groups and seen as a group of terror. Whereas now, I think the perspective does seem to be shifting, that many people don't always agree with everything that they do, but the purpose that they're fighting for seems more justified than it used to be, in a sense.
And we now need to translate that awareness into action. And there is quite a lot of polling evidence that says that people are fed up with hearing now about climate change, right? In this country, they get it, and they don't want to be keep being told, you've got to do something. What they want to hear is, yeah, what is it that you want me to do? That's the great opportunity here, because we all feel good about doing the right thing, don't we? I mean, it's the whole selfish gene thing that we don't do things, you know, the selfishness is because we get to feel good about what we've done, or in that case, we pass our genes on. This is our chance to do the right thing and do it with other people. And the world will be a better place. Well, it'll still be here for a start. But there are things we can do. We could talk about those if you're interested, but they really are practical things that everyone listening to this podcast could do over a beer immediately or a glass of wine and actually do something that is meaningful.
I have to agree with you on that, because as you said, with a lot of the awareness that's out there now, you know, figures like Greta, David Attenborough, Extinction Rebellion, yeah, really shining a light on some of these issues, there isn't really that excuse of ignorance in many, yeah, many aspects anymore. Have you noticed a shift? Obviously, this, you've been campaigning and aware for a very long time of the risks, while a lot of people haven't been. Do you think there's been a shift and a shift in change?
Monumental. Yeah. I mean, just at the beginning of last year, I was on the point of going, it's over. You know, it's over. There's nothing we can do now. No one's going to do anything at all about it. And I said to people, I've just wasted 20 years. I'm packing this in. It's that world's going to hell in a handcart and there's nothing we can do. And it changed. It changed last year. Perceptibly changed in every element of society. Well, not everyone. There are still recidivists out there. But now people want to know, they want very clear and precise instruction. What is it we have to do now? And that's what we're about at the moment, is trying to find ways to support people to make those right decisions.
It gives me a lot of hope to hear that, because obviously you've known these figures for a really long time. You've known the realities of what we're faced with. So for those of us who understand that we're in a bit of a pickle, but not really to the extent, you know, of the climate emergency, it can feel just so disheartening to think, well, we've already messed it up so badly. Where do we go from here? Is there any hope? But you sound like you feel that there is still hope. I'd like to say a huge thank you to our sponsors for this episode. World Extreme Medicine is the global leader in medical training for austere, remote, and challenging environments across the globe. They believe in making education and its impact accessible to all, offering postgraduate training, courses, conferences, webinars, podcasts, and a professional membership community. They also provide medical and rescue cover for large-scale media projects, as well as specialist consultancy. Their vision is to widen access to and broaden the appeal of extreme medicine so that every medic can apply its teaching within their practice and their lives for the benefit of society as a whole. Beyond their day-to-day work, the team have a strong passion for supporting communities in need. They are currently delivering medical aid to Ukraine through their Medics for Ukraine initiative, and have previously supported training initiatives for Myanmar and delivered medical supplies to Syria for the reconstruction of a bombed children's hospital. EcoMedics have strong links with World Extreme Medicine. Following a sustainability talk given by our co-founder Nathan at the World Extreme Medicine Conference in 2020, several conference delegates reached out to express their shared interest in healthcare sustainability, and thus EcoMedics was formed. Find out more via worldextrememedicine.com or extrememedicineexpo.com. You're talking about the action that needs to be taken now. What do you think needs to happen?
Okay, well, let's start at individual level, because that's what we've got to talk about, right? So whoever's listening to your podcast. So the first thing is make your decision to act. And that can't be an aspiration, because we all know what that's like. You meet the people in clinic who, and you say, you know, you are going to have a stroke or a heart attack if you continue to smoke. And they'll go, oh, I'll try to give up. And you know what that means is they're not going to, because I'm going to try to give up is very different from saying, I have decided, hell or high water, I am never smoking another cigarette. So the first thing is to make sure in your own mind that you're prepared to make the commitment. The second thing is to immediately engage with other people who are going to do this, because it's going to be hard to do it on your own. It's like losing weight. Weight Watchers works because you do it with 25 other people. Training in a gym works because you get someone to kick your ass and say, come on, Aisling, you said we're going to go to the gym. We're going to go to the gym. So find another group that you can go work with. And I don't mind that's your mates at medical school or your mates at university or your mates at the trust or a green anesthetic society or Extinction Rebellion or Greenpeace. It doesn't matter, but join the gang. The third thing is encourage everyone you know to act with you. So find those seven people that you know you can influence and bully them until they do. So if that's your parents, you've got to make sure that they... Right, so now we've got to go on, what is it the ask? What are you going to do with those other people when you're communicating and you've got them? So the first thing is go online to a good carbon footprint calculator. And I can send you a link to one afterwards if you want. And measure your own carbon footprint. If you do it properly, these are the calculators that take about 30 minutes. So if you've got to one that takes you 3 minutes, it's not good enough. It will ask you about the clothing you buy, the food you eat, how much you spend on that, how much you spend on electricity and gas, how you travel, how often you fly, how many phones you've got, what contracts you've got, how much IT you use, how often you use your computer screen. It will go into a lot of granularity, and it will give you a number at the end. And it will also help you understand where your big ticket items are in your life.
The carbon calculator that you mentioned, there is a link to that on our EcoMedics website. So for anybody who would like to do that, just head to our website and it'll take you through that.
Because if you don't measure it, you can't change it. And then the first thing you do is go after that and say, right, I've got to halve this, which is really difficult. Don't let me tell you that this is easy, right? It's hard. But go after that 50%. So what the hell do I stop doing to reduce my own carbon footprint? Now, some of that is relatively straightforward. So the first thing is, if you've got control over your own electricity supply, if you're renting or you own a house, you switch it to 100% renewable electricity supply. And so that deprives the fossil fuel industry of your money and it gives it to the good guys and girls. Ecotricity are excellent. Scottish Power are excellent. Octopus is excellent. There may be others, but those I can vouch for to make it easy for you. Ecotricity does things in a different way, but are also very well principled.
Energy is something that I think I hadn't really, it sounds ridiculous on sort of reflection, but it isn't something that I necessarily thought to focus so much of my time on, but actually it's the source of so much. So even if you're, you know, turning your light switches off, using less hot water, that can be kind of minuscule if we're still using fossil fuels to do those things.
Right. So switch your electricity supplier, and you can do that. It will take you seriously 10 minutes to do it. It is not painful. Your prices will not be dramatically higher, and you will have done the right thing. Secondly, you're right in terms of energy use. Use less, because whilst you've switched to a renewable supplier, we've all got to start using less energy anyway. And actually, there are some very quick wins there. So this flat, I mean, I'm lucky today because the sun's shining through this window, but normally you'd see me in not three layers, but maybe five, and sometimes with a hat on, because I don't heat the flat. You can be on Everest, actually, and be perfectly warm if you're wearing the right clothing. If you turn your central heating down by 1 degree, that reduces your greenhouse gas emissions by 7 to 11%.
That's amazing.
So if you reduce it by 5 degrees, you could have halved your greenhouse gas emissions in one go. And actually, it's perfectly possible to keep yourself warm by putting some extra clothes on. And I know that it is a generational thing. Your generation are used to being able to walk around in underwear and a T-shirt in the winter, but it shouldn't be like that. You know, I'm going to sound like I'm an old crusty, but I certainly remember as a medical student having to put layers of clothes on to go to bed and coffee freezing in our cups because it was so bloody cold. I'm not suggesting you have to live like that. So move your electricity supplier, turn your heating down, and make sure your parents and everyone else have done exactly the same thing. And you'll find the first bit's dead easy. You know, you say, well, I'm not going to fly again or whatever, and that comes down, you turn your heating down, you switch your electricity supplier. Then it starts getting difficult. So I'm not going to say this is a piece of cake. This is hard, and I can't tell you what the answers are. Food is a big one. So if you've done your heating and your power, food is a big one. And the big one is air miles and methane. So methane from paddy fields, bad. You're fermenting soil. So rice, not a good idea, especially since it's largely flown around the world or shipped. Air miles, so string beans from Kenya, etc., not a good idea. Cows and ruminants belch methane, and methane, as we say, is 83 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as is CO2. So cutting out or cutting right down on ruminant meat makes a really big difference. And milk products too. Now, you might ask why, but it's an interesting one. If you imagine, I mean, my drug of choice is coffee, and let's think of the coffee beans or cherries being grown, the coffee bean taken out. It then gets dried and shipped and processed and ground and milled, and the coffee solutes extracted, and it's reconstituted into coffee, instant coffee powder. And you melt sand to make a glass jar, and you put a plastic lid on it, and you ship that all the way around the world, and you stick it on a supermarket shelf, and I go and buy it. And water is pumped and chlorinated and put to my tap, and I fill my kettle and I boil my kettle, burning whatever it is, fossil fuels at the far end, and I fill my coffee cup. The carbon footprint of the splash of milk I add is more than all of that.
Wow.
You've got cows belching methane, and we're not even talking here about chopping down rainforests to grow the soil to feed them. But when you pasteurise milk, you might remember from your school days, you've got to heat it to above 70 degrees quickly, and then you've got to cool it, flash cool it, so it doesn't curdle and cook. And from every second thereon, it's refrigerated. So the carbon footprint of milk is very high. So moving away from ruminant meat and away from dairy products is a good thing to do.
Do you mind just clarifying what you mean about ruminants?
Well, anything that ferments grass that it's chewing to digest it, because of course cows and sheep, for instance.
So are chickens different then?
Yeah, they don't have ruminant stomachs. Cows and sheep are belching methane. Of course, meat production is much, much more carbon intensive than vegetable production. I mean, the shorthand, which is much easier, is to say try to eat as best you can a diet that is largely based on seasonable local vegetable products. So in the summer, if it's a farm shop down the road and you can buy your lettuce and your tomatoes without being forced, or you grow in the greenhouse, even better. And in the winter, if you get local carrots and parsnips and potatoes, that's good. But if it's not seasonable, it's usually in trouble. So, for instance, the carbon footprint of a banana is much lower out of season. Well, I suppose they're always in season. It's such lower than an apple out of season. Because if you eat an apple in January, it's either been flown in from Argentina or Spain, or it's been in a fridge since July.
A book that's really good for that, actually, is How Bad Are Bananas?
Yeah,
because it's strange how you assume that something like a banana, because it's grown usually somewhere more exotic than the UK, that it's going to have a gigantic carbon footprint, whereas an apple, as you said, can be grown in an orchard in England, often not, but probably hasn't got as much of a distance. But then there's the difference in the fact that one gets flown, one gets shipped. So obviously it can be difficult to know these things, but that book is brilliant because it just goes through lots of different things and debunks a lot and gives you some idea of the carbon footprint of different things, random things, an email, a cup of coffee, as you were talking about earlier, food, all sorts.
The other book I would commend, by the way, is Scott Jurek's book, Eat and Run. He won the world's ultra marathon series as a raw vegan, which I'm not suggesting everyone has to do, by the way. But the good thing about it is that he's filled the book with recipes of vegetarian things going onwards to say, I need enough calories and protein and essential amino acids and essential fatty acids. But I also, at the end of 12,000 calorie burn running 200 miles, I need a meal I'm really, really, really looking forward to. So it's full of these meals that are quick to make that taste fantastic. So I commend that too. Now, am I blameless? No, if I come round to your house and you've served me steak, I don't go, I'm sorry, Aisling, I can't touch this. You shouldn't be doing this, and give you a lecture. I say, thank you very much for my delicious meal, but I don't buy it.
I think that's the key, really, isn't it? Because people can feel very overwhelmed by, all of those things that you said is even involved in coffee. Like you start overthinking everything, and should I not even drink coffee? But I think what you're talking about there is the proportions that matter. And for example, meat and dairy, we have to eat, we have to drink, but there's certain things that have much higher carbon footprint that we should be at least reducing on. And that's the key really, is reducing.
And if you're measuring it and you've got to go 50% down, then when you're doing your shop, you're thinking, I've got to be 50% down on what I would normally buy. So if you're going to buy a steak, I'm not going to stand in your way and lecture you in the supermarket. But you're going to have to wait up and go, okay, where's that trade-off coming from now?
I think I've heard you talk about that before, actually, like almost having an energy budget. Was that you that was talking about that?
It
And
wouldn't have been me. I mean, I.
it might have been somebody else, but that's an interesting concept that you're saying. I, for example, try to eat plant-based as much as I can, but I love cheese. So if I'm not going to cut out cheese, where else am I going to cut down so that I'm still fitting that same energy budget that I'm owed personally as an individual? So I might have a certain budget. I can choose and move things around to what suits me in terms of my lifestyle, but as long as I'm keeping in mind that it's not an infinite budget that I have to spend, then that gives you some choice.
Well, it does. And again, the problem with this is it can be, as you say, overwhelming. If you say you're not allowed to this, you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to do the other, everyone goes, oh my goodness, I don't know. I'm not allowed to do anything now. In fact, you can. I mean, as I say, there's some simple things in terms of food, just going, I'm just going to make those changes. And it is a journey. It's a terrible word. I hate this. I'm on my journey. So we've done energy and power. We've done food. Transport's relatively straightforward, which is if you have to travel somewhere, try to do it on foot or on your bicycle. If you're going to have to use power to get somewhere, try to do it on Zoom or something, which does have an energy cost, but try to do it remotely. If you do have to travel, use public transport for it as mass transport. Try not to fly. And if you've got to, and that means largely traveling abroad, although there are exceptions. So, for instance, if you do say, well, actually, Hugh, I need a holiday and I'm prepared not to fly to Barbados, but I do need to go somewhere. The answer is that Eurostar, because it's powered by nuclear energy, is very, very low carbon footprint. So actually, going to France on the Eurostar is, if you're going to travel, not a stupid thing to do. So you can still get your skiing holiday in that way. I'm not suggesting that we all have to be total Puritans. It's just that there are different choices to make. So transport's relatively straightforward.
Something that I frequently struggle with coming to terms with is that even when people are armed with the full facts and have the knowledge of the realities of the change required, some people are not motivated to make the changes needed because it comes at the cost of huge personal sacrifice, which most people are not willing to do. And that's something, so for example, going on holiday in Britain, I'm sure in other places in the world as well, it's almost an entitlement that we should be able to go on holiday. We want to go on holiday. Many people are really interested in experiencing culture and experiencing language and food from across the world, which you can have access to here, but not in the same way. What kind of suggestion or what's your view on how we can tackle that?
Well, there are two issues, aren't there? Well, three, I suppose. The first is that if people say, but it's hard because I want to do X and Y, it suggests they don't understand or haven't yet accepted the reality.
Not grasp the full concept, in a sense.
Because if I said to you, if you go and drink that bottle of wine this evening and have a lovely dinner, you're going to be dead by breakfast, you wouldn't say, yeah, but I just like going out for dinner, Hugh. Would you? You wouldn't. Unless you just didn't believe the fact that the world was going to end tomorrow at breakfast time, for instance. I'm obviously horribly exaggerating, but it would, if you did genuinely believe that, you wouldn't go out for your dinner tonight unless you had suicidal tendencies. So part of it is that people have to get the fact that this is the real deal. The second is, though, that I'm not being proscriptive about this. I still own up. I have taken the odd flight. I haven't taken one for years. I may end up taking one this year for reasons that are going to be unavoidable. Well, that's not true. It's avoidable, I imagine. I may end up doing that. But I will have to deal with what I do to cut that equivalent 0.6 metric tons, which it probably will be of carbon down in response. One of the ways I do that to stop myself flying is by taxing myself. Offsetting doesn't work, by the way.
I was just about to ask you about that,
No,
actually.
it doesn't work because offsetting, it means that you've got to draw down the CO2 you emitted. And if you go to, for instance, lots of those calculators, they'll say, oh, well, if you put 40 quid into planting trees, you've offset it. It's nonsense. A broadleaf tree will draw down 5.9 kilograms of CO2 a year. And if you take a return trip to New York, that might be 2,000 kilograms of CO2.
So realistically, it seems like something that is helping people feel a bit better about offsetting essentially their emissions, but it's not really helping.
Though they're not doing enough, and it doesn't work. Again, I'm not being prescriptive. Again, if you have a mother who is sick in another country or whatever, I'm not going to say, how dare you go and visit your dying mother or whatever. Of course I'm not. But what I would say is just think about the rest of your life in the round. Say, well, if I do that, then I've really got to be paying attention to the other things too, and work out where the yin and yang is here.
Something that I think many of us feel is very fatigued by advocating for climate action and frustrated by the disconnect between what needs to be done and what is actually being done. How are you not completely disillusioned, having fought so hard over the years? And what stops you from giving up? I know you did mention earlier that you were close to that, but what has kept you going despite the fact that, in a sense, some of these issues aren't being taken anywhere near as seriously as they should be?
I suppose the first thing is just a pragmatic one about survival, which has been a research interest of mine, as you probably know, for forever. And that is the nature of survivors is that they make the assumption they can get out of it. Now, if the boat goes down, even if it's the Titanic and you can't see a life raft and the water's freezing and your body tells you the biology is going to get you, if you just go, oh, I've had it then you have had it. There is no choice if you give up. But if you fight tooth and nail to try to find that thing that will save you, then you might. So that's the first thing. It's the only logical thing to do. The second thing is your generation and its enthusiasm. I had meetings this morning with someone called Mia, who is on fire for changing things. And you cannot but be energized by mixing with such people. And they do exist in my generation, don't get me wrong. I mean, there has been some absolute leading lights in this, actually, who are much older than I am, from whom one can draw energy. I suppose the other is that those two other bits. Firstly, I sort of do like the world we live in. And whilst the worms will get me quite soon anyway, and I won't know any different, beautiful things need preserving. You don't have to have a religious persuasion to think about that. But the final beautiful thing that needs preserving is my son. As you know, I had two sons and one died not long ago. He would want me to do this, and he would want me to do it for his brother. His brother's 16. And, I can't go to my grave not feeling, I can't go to my grave feeling that I have not done everything I can to secure his future. That would be wrong.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Hugh. And it's really inspiring the work that you do, and really, true what you were saying earlier about the fact that we have these people around us who do want the best for us. And you've just given an example there that you've got children, you want them to have a flourishing future. And that's something that I worry about when I have children, if I have children, is what kind of world they're going to be living in. So thank you so much for fighting for our generation and for the future generations, because we need people like you to
Well,
help.
no, it's your war, and I will end with one thought though. You commented earlier about people not wanting to give stuff up, but being very poor is miserable. I mean, I've never been very poor, thank heavens, but it's miserable. And if you've got open sewage coming through your house and your children die in the cradle, or you're actually poor in this country, yes, money will make you happier. There is no question that it will. But beyond a certain point, it doesn't. And we know what does make you happy. That's having a purpose in life, and it's loving someone or people and being loved. That's what makes people happy. And we need to suddenly realize that we could be much, much happier in a low carbon world, if we focus on the simple things, you know, the fact that I very rarely fly now has not made my life more miserable. It's given me more time with my remaining son because I'm not away doing things. And we don't need a new clothing outfit. I mean, you know, the average online women's clothing brands that are bought are used for 10 days before they're thrown away. This sort of culture does not make people happier. We can be happy in different ways.
I've got so many questions still that I'd love to ask you. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, so I was hoping to go through some quick fire questions with you.
Go on then.
If you could give one key piece of advice to people about sustainable living, just one, what would it be?
Act. Do something. Do it. Don't talk about doing it. And actually, I suppose in that, if I'm allowed to sort of hedge it a little bit, make it meaningful action. Don't fool yourself by saying I'm being more sustainable, because more sustainable is not sustainable.
What do you wish you knew sooner?
What I wish I would have known was that I was right. I was saying this stuff over the years, but still part of me hoping that it might not be going to end up that way. If I'd absolutely known, rather than I think we're at risk of this, it looks like where we're going, I'd known it was happening, I would have quit my job and been fighting for nothing but this 20 years ago.
What will you tell future generations about your role in the climate crisis?
That I failed, probably. That I didn't commit hard enough, early enough. Yeah, I should have done more. That's what I would say.
Wow, I feel that I can't move on without addressing that, because it sounds like you have very high expectations because you know how hard we need to be working to prevent the inevitable. But I think you've done amazing work. And obviously, I've mentioned personally that I've been inspired by you. So yes, please just know that you are being extremely hard on yourself. And if I was a future, I am a future generation, and I don't think you failed at all. Describe to us your version of a greener world.
We need to cherish what we have and to enjoy it for what it is, not view it as a world that we can plunder by chopping down rainforests, predating and all the animals, forcing through the other, causing spillover events, then locking ourselves down when those viruses spread around the world because 146 people a second are boarding a jet plane and rushing and breathing polluted air and getting overweight because we're eating mass-produced stuff that we don't need to, that a lot of that can go. So a world that actually is more connected to nature, where we are rebuilding nature's stores rather than plundering them.
Can the health sector become truly sustainable?
But it needs a big change. So you probably need to sack people like me, because intensive care is mostly a failure of public health policy. So there are people that, I don't know, fall down the stairs or get hit by a car or get a cancer or whatever. And of course, we should be there for them in every way. But the vast majority of what we see in hospitals now is entirely preventable disease. It's due to poverty and iniquity, but it's due to air pollution and road traffic accidents and alcohol and tobacco and poor diets, because rubbish food is cheap. And if you got rid of those sorts of things, 11 different diseases drop colossally in their prevalence, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or strokes or heart attacks or breast cancer or bowel cancer or obesity or diabetes. So the first thing we need to do is change our way of doing things. And that requires policy change and taxation change to make healthy living easy and bad living more expensive, keeping people healthier. And oddly enough, of course, the things that keep you healthy just happen to keep the planet healthy. That can't be a coincidence. A diet-based load, mainly on local seasonal vegetable products, taking active transport and using your body to move and breathing clean air, happens to be really good for you. It happens to be really, really good for the planet at the same time.
Interestingly, that's something we've not actually had a chance to talk about today, which is healthcare sustainability, which is the topic of the podcast. But we will be exploring, you know, that in various different contexts, air pollution, plant-based diets in future episodes. But what I think I've really gained from talking to you today is it's not just, within the healthcare sector that healthcare professionals can make a difference. And actually, outside is where we can make a massive, massive difference.
Absolutely.
So Hugh, thank you so much for your generosity and sharing your time with me yet again today to give such powerful insight into the climate crisis. I'm grateful for the commitment you have to sharing the challenges we face in halting climate change and the urgency in which we must take action.
It's my pleasure, actually. Thanks for having me. Thanks for your time too.
EcoMedics is a non-profit organisation challenging health professionals and the healthcare industry to recognise the urgency of the climate crisis and to implement change to become sustainable. To stay up to date with our projects and events, and for climate news and sustainability tips, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @eco_medics and sign up to our newsletter using the link below or by heading to newsletter.ecomedics.co.uk. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website, www.ecomedics.co.uk, where you can calculate your carbon footprint, carbon offset your unavoidable emissions, access step-by-step sustainability guides, and buy from our non-profit shop with carefully selected sustainable partners. EcoMedics is run by a team of volunteers, and all proceeds go into the running costs of the organisation. If you want to show your support, you can also donate by heading to buymeacoffee.com/EcoMedics. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and don't forget to share this episode with friends and family and on social media. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode. Bye for now.